Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Diversicare versus Rubio.
May it please the court, Ms. Audrey from there, which is the petitioner, which is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, counsel. The issue presented in this case is whether the defendant's status as a healthcare provider and the plaintiff's status as a patient can be taken out of the equation when assessing whether a claim is a healthcare liability claim. When we look at a patient's cause of action against an institutional healthcare provider, a nursing home, a mental health facility, a hospital, it's the care that is to be provided to that patient that is critical to the analysis and cannot be ignored.
If someone had broken into a window and sexually assaulted the plaintiff here, would it be a different case?
I do believe it would be a different case.
Because the operative negligent act is security related rather than patient care, than understaffing related.
That is the position of Diversicare in this case, Your Honor. It's Diversicare's position that these institutional health care facilities have folks in them because they are compromised physically or mentally in some way. They need to have some sort of professional health care service to care for them and to supervise and to monitor them in some capacity. Now, the issue that this is what they've signed on for, to provide health care services. They're not necessarily in the security business. I'm not sure that we could place a nursing home or a hospital in any other position than in this building, perhaps. Supervision from outside sources, from random acts of violence, I think it's a different issue entirely. In fact, when I was a prosecutor many years ago, we had a case in a nursing home where a defendant from outside actually came into the nursing home, took a fire extinguisher off the wall, and started to beat a resident over the head with it. He was sitting in a wheelchair out in the hallway. Now, at that time, as a prosecutor, obviously, my concern wasn't with whether that was a healthcare liability claim or not. But in preparing for this oral argument, I thought about situations just like that one. And Diversicare would distinguish a random act of violence from outside of the facility.
What if this sexual assault occurred in a healthcare facility that did not have the responsibility of as part of the care provided to take care of the entire patient who is unable to take care of themselves? So let's say the assault occurred in a general hospital instead of a mental care facility or some facility of that sort. Would the analysis and the outcome change?
I don't believe so. At the end of the day, the analysis to be performed in this case is this. The healthcare facility is required to assess the care needs of each patient that comes into that facility, whether, again, it's a nursing home, a mental health facility, or a hospital. The care needs of the patient are assessed. The healthcare services commensurate with those care needs are to be performed. That would include providing whatever healthcare services are necessary to protect that person from harm. We believe that that would also include potentially protecting that person from another patient from within the facility, regardless of what kind of a facility it is.
My dentist's office and the person in the next chair takes umbrage at what I'm saying.
Now, this case is distinguishable from a situation where you're in sort of an outpatient facility, if you would, or in a general practitioner's office. And we can certainly discuss issues just like that, although I don't think the Diversicare case presents that. This case presents to the court the institutional healthcare context. Now, in a dentist's office,
that's fine. I see your
when we talk about, for instance, nursing homes, as the plaintiffs have contended in this case, and as the AARP argues in its own brief, they say residents in nursing homes are entitled to have their fundamental care needs met. And we recognize that this is what nursing homes do. They are to provide and be sure that their residents obtain the highest practicable physical, mental, and psychosocial well-being. We recognize that residents are supposed to be able to attain the highest level of daily activity. In other words, they need help, we know, with potentially bathing, grooming, dressing, eating, using the restroom, maneuvering in bed and out. We also know that by statute they should not have diminished their abilities in speech and in
speaking about that statute. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Justice. What the specific statute of the language in 45901 that we're talking about here, is it your position that this language is in any way ambiguous?
Is it in any way ambiguous? Your Honor, we believe that very clearly Article 4590I defines a health care liability claim as a departure from the standards of medical care, health care, and safety. Now, the legislature has not defined safety, but they've told us to apply the common law meaning, and safety means freedom from harm or the risk of harm. Now, in the context of nursing homes, for instance, we have had patients who have stated that, we see cases in which patients state that they've had bed sores. They've sustained brain injuries, falling out of bed. This court saw that in the Palacios case. We have a case where a woman is in a wheelchair, and her wheelchair is pushed up against a table, and her leg is broken. That's a different case in another court of
appeal. Well, I'm mainly interested from the aspect of whether or not, when we go to interpret the statute, whether or not you look at legislative intent.
I think absolutely you do look at legislative intent. And what's
interesting, even though it's not ambiguous.
Well, it is not ambiguous when we look at the intent of the legislature. And for instance, when Article 4590I was promulgated in 1977, the legislature had the opportunity to include an exclusion to the definition of health care liability claim, which it could be perhaps, and the way the plaintiffs argued that their case is framed, would apply to in this exclusion. Again, the exclusion has been deleted. And it states, a health care liability claim does not apply to negligence not directly related to the furnishing of medical or health care to the patient, including but not limited to premises defects, vehicular accidents, and other negligent acts not related to a health care liability claim.
So you take the position that legislative intent can be determined from what's excluded from the bill?
Your Honor, yes. It's DiversiCare's position that based upon the fact that the legislature could have included this exclusion in the definition of health care liability claim and did not so include it, tells us that the legislature intends to interpret what is a health care liability claim very broadly. It appears to us that they intend to apply it broadly to whatever is a health care liability claim.
Is there any authority in Texas holding different than that?
Your Honor, this is the first case before this court that talks about an institutional health care facility.
No, I mean about the exclusion language.
Your Honor, I am not familiar. I am not personally familiar with language in Texas that states that exclusionary language should not be considered.
Thank you.
Let me ask again about a couple of examples that have been brought up already. You indicated that if someone broke into the hospital from outside of the hospital, a third party, then and assaulted Ms. Rubio, there would not be a claim under the Medical Liability Act, correct?
We do not. We believe that that could be separated. We believe that that could be under the CGL policy.
And then you said that the amount of care, the responsibility to provide a certain amount of care depends upon what the patient requires and what they're there for.
Yes.
What if the patient is like Mrs. Rubio and cannot take care of herself, has dementia or strong Alzheimer's, depending on what part of the record you read? Why wouldn't it then, under your test, be the responsibility of the health care institution to protect her from a break-in from by a third party, whereas a patient down the hall might be a strapping 6'4", 300-pound male who could protect himself? Based on your standard, why does the third party breaking into the hospital change the analysis for Ms. Rubio?
Well, I think DiversiCare realizes we have to draw the line somewhere. I know Dean Treese is fond of the saying slippery slope, and we're certainly trying to stay away from a slippery slope here. I think that institutional healthcare facilities are not necessarily in the business of security from the outside world. I mean, I think that they do stand in the same place as a premises owner for purposes of known dangers from the outside world. Once we get into the inside world, and particularly in cases where you have mental health facilities and nursing home facilities, you have a much more of this patient-on-patient assault activity because so many of the patients are mentally compromised in some way. These facilities, this is what they've signed on to do, to control patient interaction and to protect the patients from one another, is yet another healthcare concern, healthcare task, healthcare duty that they take on. They're uniquely suited for this position. This is healthcare by its very nature.
So your standard then, is it assault caused by folks who are external to the facility versus internal to the facility? What I'm trying to get a sense of your standard.
Well, it's our position in this case, that this case is about a patient-on-patient assault within the confines of this institutional health care facility.
I understand that. Of course, the court has to resolve this case.
Sure.
We also have to be mindful of its implications and ramifications. I'm frankly testing your theory.
I understand. We hesitate to ask this court to extend an internal institutional incident beyond the doors of the facility. At that point, then the nursing home or the hospital or the healthcare facility, it stands in the shoes of a business. That's why they have a CGL policy to cover that. We hesitate to ask this court to extend this outside the doors of the facility.
Let me ask you this. In fashioning some sort of test, just take a minute, so bear with me. What would be wrong with a test that posited something along the line of, if it's something that requires medical testimony as to a standard of care? Now, let's presume this were a staff member who had attacked the plaintiff here. And the claim was that they had negligently hired this person with a criminal background.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding under this former test would be that that would not be a health care liability claim, because there you're looking at the employer for negligently hiring someone who had a criminal background. Whereas it strikes me that patient to patient, the underpinnings of that are understaffing. And what the standard of care in terms of staffing for an Alzheimer's unit would be becomes more of something that needs expert testimony, health care liability, than the other situation I just posited.
No,
would a test like that work, is my question.
Yeah. At the end of the day, as this court has held in other cases before where plaintiffs have tried to recast their claims as DTPA, breach of warranty type claims, this court has said we need to look at the standard of care. We need to look at the nature of the plaintiff's claim. So we must be mindful of the fact that the plaintiff, in cases such as these, is an inpatient is inpatient in a healthcare facility, not a resident in an apartment complex, because the standards of care are greater within the facility. They're in some respects exponentially greater in a healthcare facility, and the duties that are owed by that facility to their residents than what is owed by an apartment complex to their residents. And so when you look at a plaintiff's claim that they have not been provided the healthcare services that they needed to protect them from harm within the facility, whether that's a bed sore, a brain injury falling out of bed, we've seen fatal injuries with people falling out of windows. The analysis is the same when it's a patient-on-patient assault.
So you say the scenario where the orderly is the assaulter and the claim is they were negligent in hiring him because he had a criminal background, you'd still say that was a health care liability claim? No.
Well, we may be walking a line with that one, too, because I'm mindful of the Rose versus Garland Hospital case that the court will hear in November, where it's the negligent credentialing and recredentialing of the physicians and whether that is a health care liability claim. I realize Dallas split a line in timing and determined that was an act that was taken well prior to the actual course of treatment, and therefore that was not a health care liability claim. It is conceivable, I suppose, that at the end, this orderly is supposed to be providing care and services to this patient.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but on the credentialing, negligent credentialing, would you need expert testimony to determine whether there was negligent credentialing?
I would think so. The ordinary juror could not possibly know whether a doctor was properly credentialed.
Right, but you would not need expert testimony where an orderly there's a claim of negligent hiring because of a criminal background. You would need expert medical testimony.
That, with respect to that issue, that's true. Now, it may
and
be...
And how about here? Take these facts. Let's suppose you... Well, if you look... Suppose you win for the next case. The plaintiff is going to need expert testimony. What's it going to look like? And what is your expert response going to be?
Well, in this case... And there are so many others like it. The crux of the allegation here is that there was improper staffing of nurses in training and number to provide the health care services that these residents, and in particular Ms. Rubio, needed. They say that was the instrumentality that caused not only leg fractures, which caused the filing of this suit in the first place, but also this assault committed by another patient. The test is... And this is where expert testimony comes in and standard of care and the nature of the claim. But these patients have to be assessed for their mental and physical condition, and they need to be assessed for the health care that they need to keep them protected from various harms. In this case, this is a woman with Alzheimer's in her 80s who was in a facility with other folks who were mentally compromised. Not only did they need to be protected from themselves, she needed to be protected from herself and from others. The ordinary juror can't know what is the proper supervision of these patients, the proper handling of these patients, whether it's Mrs. Rubio or it's the gentleman who's alleged to have assaulted her.
So if the patient, if understaffing is the claim, you would need expert testimony for that. If you had a staff member there observing one patient aggressively going into another's room and you did nothing to stop that, mm-hmm. there could be liability there because that doesn't relate to staffing or it doesn't relate to just...
That, to me, that goes back to supervision, and that goes back to healthcare services performed by the facility for the person who's having their room aggressively approached by the other patient. At the end of the day, I think it comes down to supervision and monitoring, and this is what these healthcare facilities are suited to do. Again, as we talked about with nursing homes and with mental health facilities, where your folks are very often mentally compromised, you have so much incidence of this. And so at the end of the day, it's were these folks assessed for what healthcare needs had to be met for them? Were those healthcare needs met? And did the alleged failure to meet those needs proximately cause their injury? At the end of the day, that's the standard of care that this court has sought to impose in 4590I cases. You need an expert to talk about assessment and providing proper care and causation. And also, this is healthcare by its very definition under Article 4590I. It's an act performed by the healthcare facility for the patient during the course of their confinement. And a departure from that standard of medical care or safety is a healthcare liability claim under Article 4590I. So the Court of Appeals has improvidently reversed the trial court summary judgment in this case.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Gerald Treese will present argument for respondent.
Counsel, may it please the court. Your Honors, this case involves the question that is uniformly agreed upon by not just the 13th court in the underlying case, but the 5th court in Dallas in the Bush case, likewise the 1st court out of Houston, the 14th court in Houston. All these courts together say the same thing. They say that when you have a sexual assault against a person at one of these facilities, the question becomes, is this even medical treatment involved? Second,
what if you had a physical assault?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What if you had a physical assault, not a sexual assault? Same stuff.
Matter of fact, that happened, Your Honor, in the Rigby case. Mm-hmm. Each of these cases has some of the most chilling stories contained in these cases. The Rigby case, for example, out of the 14th court, authored in part by Judge Brister, pointed out the fact that these type of claims have nothing at all to do with medical diagnosis or treatment. What they have to do is with garden variety, as Judge Brister referred to it, or regular negligence cases.
But what about the argument that this has to do with staffing?
Well, and Your Honor, that the court, literally the first court in Gobert, G-O-B-E-R-T, addressed that question. It said even if it is, it doesn't have anything to do with medical treatment. And the calling of any experts on the question of the standard of care, you can do that if your car breaks down and you get it fixed. You can get an expert.
It seems to me that it does have something to do with it because, for example, in our shop, we're not accustomed to people hitting on each other during the course of the day.
Certainly not.
We take it that they've been, part of their training includes not doing that. So we don't have to have monitors standing around making sure there are no assaults. But it's quite different in this environment where people don't behave rationally.
But you,
and how would you have to know, I mean, do we have two people for each one?
But Your Honor, I think that question goes to the issue that I'm addressing. I don't doubt that you may have an expert who testifies in numerous cases.
No, a medical expert.
Not a medical expert, because it's not a medical standard of care.
That's health care. I mean,
yes, ma'am.
In order to prove understaffing, there's got to be some testimony that a nursing home of this with the Alzheimer's unit, there needs to be more staffing here. What's the reasonable staffing for a medical facility like this?
Yes, ma'am.
And medical or healthcare related in that sense, expert. I didn't mean just any.
Yes, ma'am. But it's not medical treatment, which is the issue under this Medical Liability Improvement Act. The question is there medical treatment or diagnosis? And then the crucial issue is medical expert testimony, keyword, required to do what? To establish the standard of care for that profession.
If we were writing the statute, we might have chosen to include those words, but they're not in the statute. I don't see medical testimony. I'm struggling with the definition of health care liability claim. And what the legislature has put in writing that we have to deal with is a claim against a health care provider from accepted standards of safety. Well, doesn't say anything about medical testimony.
I apologize, Judge. Part of the analysis has been if there is a professional standard of care for a medical service provider. That's something a doctor, a nurse is trained in medical school on. Nowhere in medical school does anyone have a course on preventing rape of patients. This is garden variety, premises liability, negligence. And, Your Honor, the important point on this is sometimes you can get a harmony with different courts of appeal, and it may make a little difference. In this case, when you have the Dallas court, the San Antonio court, the Corpus court, and both Houston courts looking at the very issues the court's asking me about and saying you can segregate, you can sever a premises liability claim because it doesn't have anything to do with medical treatment.
Well, but I'm still struggling with that because it looks like to me if you were going to prove one of these cases, you wouldn't hire Brinks or Wells Fargo or some security company to come, or the police department, an off-duty police officer to come in and say, you have to have this kind of staffing. You hire a nursing home expert that comes in and says, oh, well, if you've got these kind of patients, you have to look after them this way because otherwise they'll hurt each other.
But Your Honor, that issue is what the first court looked at and the 14th court looked at, and what they opined was this, that it's okay in a regular negligence case to bring in expert testimony. As I was mentioning, if your car breaks down and you take it in, it doesn't get fixed right, you might get an expert to come in and say what happened, but it doesn't make it a professional standard of care. And the medical malpractice improvement law, what was attempting to do, even if we accept the petitioner's argument, and that somehow that this healthcare crisis is what was behind the passing of this, the whole question seemed vague to me because in answer to questions, counsel even reminded everyone that traditional premises liability claims, like the person who comes in a window, not even handled by malpractice insurance. And the price of insurance wouldn't go up. They're handled under comprehensive global liability policies, just like if you're hurt at Kmart or if you're hurt at a restaurant. And the irony would be that the people in our society who get least protection, these individuals who are in these nursing homes, would be treated worse under our law than a person that goes to Denny's or a person that goes to Kmart, a person that goes to a restaurant and has a premises liability claim.
Dean Treese, let's look at the statute again. The definition of healthcare liability claim says there's liability, among other things, for a claim departure from accepted standards of medical care or health care or safety. Presuming the legislature meant to include each word in that phrase that's included, and they weren't overlapping or being redundant, then you conclude that safety means something different from health care and medical care. What did the legislature intend safety to mean, since they stated it separately and specifically?
The answer is in two parts, Your Honor. I can't directly answer what the legislature intended, but each of the cases that I addressed before that stand as a bulwark of authority have answered that question that you can sever if, in fact, the claim that's being made can be isolated from the medical treatment issue, which is the third part of the test that's being used by the courts. The courts answer that question by asking, is it dealing with diagnosis or treatment? If so, is it a requirement to have an expert testimony,
but,
and then finally,
again,
can you segregate?
I'm asking you to focus on the language of the statute because that's what we've got to look at, and they talk about the legislature chose the words, not a court. and they defined health care to include any act during the patient's confinement. Now, that's what health care is defined as. And they've also included, as Judge Wainwright points out, word safety in here. So those are words we've got to deal with, and they're not tied to medical treatment. Medical care is defined in a separate section right below it. Medical care is not tied to any of these definitions. So what do we do with the words confinement, during a patient's confinement, any act, and the word safety? It's not linked with medical care.
Yes, ma'am, I agree. And with Candor, none of the courts directly struggle with either the legislative intent or the direct answer to your question. But what they're looking at is the severability. The question is, can this claim stand alone without any question of if a health care provider is involved? Does it make it more akin to a premises liability?
Okay, so let's how's it going to be tried if it stands alone?
Perfect question, Judge. And you know, to me, when I was sitting there listening to the argument today, that's the best way to analyze this, I think. Because if this case goes back to trial, you're not going to have a professional standard of care issue.
Well, but it's, how's it going to be argued? Your argument to the jury is going to be understaffing, isn't it?
It's going to be an ordinary negligence premises liability claim.
But who are you going to call as your expert to prove that they did not follow the standard of care? It's not going to be an office duty policeman. It's going to be a nursing home administrator.
Unlike a medical malpractice claim where medical expert testimony is required, you may not even have to have an expert on the question of understaffing. Because you can go to the jury in Texas on a garden variety ordinary negligence case without any expert testimony.
But you're agreeing that the underlying negligent act is going to be understaffing?
Well, not necessarily, because the Reese opinion out of this court in 1999 pointed out that on a premises liability case, the issue is if there was a known danger on
premises.
But the known danger is understaffing.
That's right. It was a structural defect in that
case. What's the premises defect in this case?
In this case, it's the fact that you have people who cannot literally take care of themselves.
Well, what's the premises defect? What was wrong with the building that caused the...
Inadequate safety, the failure to protect these people from those rapists that seem, for reasons unknown to me, to be moving among nursing homes. These are all nursing home cases, and they're all different people who are sexually assaulting
Here's a question I was going to ask on that point. The premise of the argument is the vulnerability of these patients that's caused by their medical condition. The whole reason they're there is because they require medical care and a medical assessment. How, then, can we separate that from what happened? I mean, how is this all not intertwined?
But Your Honor, I'm not powerful enough to show this court how everyone, very seldom can I say this, everyone agrees with me. Every court that struggle with these questions of looking at a sexual assault at a nursing home, not just in Texas, the AARP brief that's filed in conjunction with our response also points out the other states looking at this same question have all said separate the claim.
But if those were medical malpractice cases.
And this is not a medical malpractice.
Under the common law, and they weren't looking at a statute. The only issue in this case is whether the statute of limitations applies.
That's correct.
And here's a question I want to get back to. You were arguing, why should we treat these people different from someone that's at Kmart? And the only question about difference in treatment is which statute of limitations is going to apply.
I agree with you.
And so we've got to look at what the legislature said about here's the limitations that applies. It applies to these kinds of claims, and we've got to look at their language, not the common law, not whether this is a medical malpractice claim, but their language.
Respectfully, Your Honor, we have to decide if this type of premises liability claim is somehow subsumed under the medical malpractice improvement statute, because we believe, and the courts in Texas have uniformly looked at this and said it doesn't apply to medical malpractice when a premises liability issue such as this, when a rapist does harm to people under the charge of that nursing home or that hospital. Nursing care and medical treatment has nothing to do with it. And to answer your question, this case can go to a jury on an ordinary negligence submission. It's not a professional standard of care. It's a garden variety negligence standard of duty, breach of duty, causation, and damages. And I really believe that if you don't even have to have an expert on this, because this court,
you'd have to concede it's inextricably intertwined with what's necessary for an Alzheimer patient to staff ratio.
I think it's a function of that. I think that's right. But it's not a question of the medical treatment that this legislature looked at. When it said we've got to do something about the cost of malpractice insurance because the premiums are driving up the rates and doctors can't get insurance and that's bad for Texas. And I agree that maybe that's true. But at the same time, what is also wrong with that argument is the issue of premises liability is not even an issue in medical malpractice. This is not a claim against the medical malpractice coverage. This is the comprehensive liability policy that every facility has. So it doesn't even touch, that's the irony of this, doesn't even touch the medical malpractice crisis.
Dean Treese, you've mentioned the courts of appeals in Texas that have, you said, held uniformly in support of your position. I think I'm familiar with the cases in the district you've mentioned. Only one of them addresses safety expressly.
That's correct.
That's Rogers v. Corpus Christi, 1999, correct?
Rogers versus Crossing.
Correct. And the discussion is one paragraph.
That's also correct.
Okay, so there's not been any focus, in all candor, by the courts of appeals generally on this issue of safety.
Admittedly so.
Looking at the statute and the use of the word safety, separate from medical care and health care, I think we all agree it has to relate somehow to the treatment of the patient. It can't. We don't mean general safety in the sense of being safe when walking down the sidewalk in a city. So it relates somehow to treatment. Do you have a two questions. Do you have a definitive idea or theory of what safety in this context means, separate from health care and medical care?
Conceding the fact that you're correct, I believe the Rogers Court is the court that addresses its definition and its meaning. Outside of the context of health care, the answer of safety in premises liability cases is well known. There's a duty to warn of those things the owner knows or is reasonably certain to know of. That's the duty that arises in premises cases.
And you talked about the, I think you called it the crucial factor is whether medical testimony is required. Is that your standard?
No, Your Honor. That's the standard of the 14th Court, the 1st Court, the Corpus Court, the San Antonio Court. All the courts that have looked at this have come up with this three-part
test. Let me change my question. Is that the standard you want us to, or the factor you think our court should focus on in deciding this issue, whether medical expert testimony is required?
Your Honor, I think it's not a test, it's a factor. It's a flexible factor, because as I've said
and
earlier.
And what are the other factors?
Well, the first factor is there really medical treatment involved? Is there medical treatment diagnosis involved? If there is there a professional standard of care that's required to even survive summary judgment? If you don't have that professional standard of care, then the case is over. And then the third step that's embraced by the 14th Court, also embraced by, I think, the most excellent analysis of the 5th Court in Dallas in the Bush versus Green Oaks case, it embraces the problem and talks about the three-part test and says, this is the way to look at it because you can segregate, says step three. You can segregate some claims. The attempt is to segregate. And, you know, to me, while there's a great rush to attempt to help healthcare providers, the legislature's in a perfect attempt to come up with meanings and definitions instead of asking this court to come in and weigh in and say whatever the issue is, if something happens on a healthcare property that is somehow covered under this limitation of the act. See, I think that's bad law for Texas and bad law for Texas.
Let me ask you this. I'm just trying to get an idea of where you think the line is drawn. But I suppose if an orderly were helping the patient into bed and dropped the patient or didn't do it right and the patient fell, would you think that was a health care?
Surely it is, Judge. It's medical treatment that's being provided and done so negligently, a professional standard of care would apply.
And if the orderly brought in a meal and spilled it on them and burned them, would that be?
Using the analogy to the airline cases, dealing with what's preempted and what's not, the answer is probably yes.
That would be a health care liability claim.
Yes.
And if they walked off and left them when they shouldn't have and the patient falls over or something, that would be too, I guess.
So case specific, because as counsel's correctly pointed out, there are too many cases that are wrongly pled that are really under the act, where misrepresentation is tried by the plaintiff's side to try to get around the Medical Malpractice Act that are nothing more than misdiagnosis cases. It's a like Shaw, for example, and like Gomez, for example. This side agrees. We carry no brief in support of those misguided cases. On the other hand, when you can clearly separate what treatment is implied or suggested by allowing rapists to run around wards at any type of healthcare facility, especially as the AARP group points out, are our most vulnerable citizens, who are usually women, who for reasons unknown to other people outlive men, and that these women in these healthcare facilities are quite often left alone. They have no support. They're Medicaid, Medicare receivers, and the facility receives that money. At the same time, what medical treatment's involved by keeping rapists away from these women? That's the issue. It's not medical treatment at all. So you don't even get past the first test.
Sorry to interrupt you. Let me take a couple more steps in Judge Heck's analogies. What if the doctor says, I'm leaving, it's midnight, nurse, I know you're the typical nurse from Miss Rubio, don't go, and said, I'm going to send Sam. Sam, in his records, but unbeknownst to the doctor, is a person involved in assaults and has those tendencies.
And this is an employee, Judge?
An employee, both of them. He goes and assaults Miss Rubio, but the doctor said, because of Sam, your expertise and something else, I'm sending Sam instead of the normal nurse. Now I'm going home and an assault takes place.
I think that's different.
Medical judgment or not?
Medical treatment. And I think the line of distinction is there is no medical provision, treatment, or any suggestion that rape is a good thing for patients at healthcare facilities. But when a doctor does treatment and a doctor makes recommendations, there's the Shaw case, I believe it was, where it was held to be a medical healthcare claim. The person got misdiagnosed, they overdosed, and they fell out of a window. Well, the doctor's involved with that. The doctor is treating the patient. In medical school, there's no block of instruction dealing with preventing rape of women at healthcare facilities. It's a premises case. It's separate from the medical healthcare claim.
And another hypothetical. I know as a law professor you like these and probably use them.
I live there, Judge.
Next step. The doctor, knowing that treating physician from Miss Rubio knows that she can't take care of herself, could hurt herself, instructs that her door be locked by the nurse whenever there's not a hospital employee or a physician in there. Medical judgment?
May I answer your question? I see my time is up, Jay. The answer to that question is fact-specific again, but with a doctor's involvement in the issue, the answer could well be that could fall under what the legislature intended. But the legislature had no intent, because they did not have a broad definition that says anything that happens at a healthcare facility is under this act. They had limitations. And the courts, your sister courts, have struggled with what is meant by the difference between medical services provided and then garden variety negligence that occurs.
Excuse me, Dean Treese, one more
please.
Analogy or hypothetical. The doctor, same situation with Ms. Rubio, understands that because of her situation, she is subject to being controlled, hurt by others, and for that reason, instructs that her door.
Other patients or other employees.
Other patients.
Fact specific. Perhaps that's true.
Or no medical judgment. Involved.
It could well be, but without medical judgment, that's the factor that I think weighs the heaviest in all these cases. That's how once a doctor when they make a bad diagnosis and really bizarre things happen. Our courts, the same courts that agree with us, also say medical treatment's involved when there's a diagnosis, even if it's a misdiagnosis.
And so the underlying premise of all that is there is no medical judgment in determining how much staff is needed.
That's right.
For those patients more in need of supervision. Than
Your Honor, you're saying exactly what our position is. As a matter of fact, the petitioner referred to the Rose versus Garland case, which also has to do with the case that's before this court, and it has to do with credentialing problems. And I see the difference in those types of cases is administrative things that happen in hospitals just don't require. They're not medical treatment. They're administrative things that happen in hospitals. And the attempt by petitioner and others, not personally, but the attempt by the side representing that the petitioner is attempting to expand coverage under an act where the legislature has had no problem at all filling in the blanks for the petitioner. The court should not accept that invitation. The court should salute those opinions that have been struggled through, the five opinions, unanimously, of our courts of appeal in Texas on this subject.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The opinions that Dean Treese has been speaking of this morning are all cases that have not been presented to this court for review. The problem that we're seeing across the state is this, that these courts are relying upon each other's opinions, their improvident opinions, oftentimes inapposite opinions.
Do you think some sort of medical or medical-related testimony is necessary to prove liability in a situation like this?
Absolutely, Your Honor. In fact, the plaintiffs conceded in the trial court that they were going to bring an expert in nursing services to establish that there had been understaffing in this case, which caused Ms. Rubio's injuries.
That's in the record?
Absolutely, it is, Your Honor. In fact, that's one of the issues that we've presented to the court in our petition for review in this case.
Could you prove it in some other way? Could you prove without medical care, medical testimony, that there was a violation of standard of care?
It is difficult to conceive of how the average person on the street would know what the patient to staff ratio is for an Alzheimer's patient, what's appropriate in a nursing home facility, how much staffing do you need. When you look at the plaintiff's petition in this case, this whole case is about supervision, it's about alleged understaffing, it's about failure to hire and train appropriate personnel to monitor and supervise Maria Rubio. Tab F to our brief on the merits shows the court the pertinent portions of the plaintiff's amended petition in this case, where they speak specifically to our alleged failure to protect this woman because we did not have enough staff on board to prevent this gentleman from entering her room.
Should we look at cases that talk about coverage under medical policies versus general liability policies? I mean, we just decided a case recently that where an orderly stole drugs, right, and whether that was covered under a medical policy or general liability policy.
Right.
Should that drive those cases drive our analysis in any way?
I don't know if they drive the analysis in any way. I suppose they are instructive. And, you know, in that case, I know that the court recognized the fact that the parties, I guess, sort of agreed that the act of keeping the medicine cabinet secure was sort of just a general liability issue, not a professional issue. But I don't know. I'm not sure that diverse care necessarily agrees with that. At the end of the day, again, we are talking about health care services provided to all the folks in that facility, and particularly the folks who ultimately were administered the tainted drugs. It could, yes, perhaps be instructive to look at cases where you look at the CGL policy and look at the professional liability exclusion to see where that's been applied and where it has not. DiversiCare has not provided that analysis, would be glad to do so if it would be helpful to the court. At the end of the day, we believe that the standards that have already been espoused by this court will govern, which is we look to the nature of the claim, we look to the standard of care and whether it's a health care claim, we look to whether an expert is going to be necessary in the analysis. Will the plaintiffs need that to prove their claim? And then at the end of the day, in this Rubio case, we need to look at the judicial admissions made by the plaintiffs, the fact that the alleged same instrumentality caused both injuries, whether it be the injuries to her leg or the assault. We look to the fact that the plaintiffs told the court that they would bring in a nursing staff expert to prove up their case. And we look to the fact that at oral argument in the Court of Appeals, different counsel for plaintiffs told the court, Ms. Rubio was an Alzheimer's patient. That's why we put her in this facility. That coupled with the plaintiff's petition that said we needed her fundamental care needs to be met, along with a 26-item list of nursing staff inadequacies, shows that this case is absolutely, by its very nature, a health care liability claim.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes today's arguments. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All right. Oh, yeah. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas.